So, ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll get started on our next session. If I could ask you, please, to gentlemen, just to take a seat, if I may. Thank you. Say again? No. But I will resort to gratuitous violence, given half a chance. In fact, this feels a bit like the First World War. There's in a giant no man's land between the panel and the audience, but I'm sure we'll bridge the gap. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about, as on the slide, bringing deterrence in Europe up to date. And to help us along, we've two very distinguished speakers. Nearest to me, Ambassador Sorin Dukaro, who is the director of the European Satellite Centre. And I think that refers to things in space, not the geopolitical situation of the UK in about February. And furthest away from me, Greg Melcher, who is the Chief Operations Officer of the Center for the Study of New Generation Warfare in the USA and with the Virginia Tech Applied Research Corporation. And both gentlemen have a distinct digital age technical bent, which will be very useful for the discussion that we are trying to encourage. But in setting the scene for the problem of deterrence in Europe for our current age, I would like to lay out for you by means of introduction, a number of factors or questions that we need to be able to consider in our deliberations. The first, and we've just covered it, is the challenge of dealing with what is perceived as an ambitious, assertive, and aggressive Russia under Putin and its effect, therefore, on NATO and Europe. And I have written down the expression, in the case of Mr. Putin, the autocrat on a tightrope. Secondly, for Europe, the growing sense that there are different problems to be considered with different geography. So there is going to be a discussion about the Arctic, about the Balkans, from a Polish perspective, a German perspective, the challenge of Eastern Europe feels it has, and Turkey and the Black Sea. That is quite a complex problem set for European deterrence. And in there, of course, a huge range of national perspectives for NATO, an alliance that's grown from 12, which hung together reasonably easily during the Cold War, to 29, trending 30, that have very different views about the drama that you face if you're in the north, the center, or the south. I think next, the requirement that European deterrence has got to acknowledge what is beginning to feel like a very different relationship with the United States, not just under the current rather colourful president, but also a growing sense that the US taxpayer is becoming increasingly reluctant to underwrite European security and allow us to have a rather more generous social offer than they afford themselves in a climate when they have other things they think to worry about, whether that's their enormous national debt or the problem of China. And the fact is, European deterrence, which was once all about Russia, is now having to consider what to deter in an increasingly multipolar world. The rise of China in this century, the state-level strategic challenge posed to our interests from Iran, the potential for terrorism to develop from something that is clearly, I think, now not a strategic threat to something that would be strategic if it successfully acquired weapons of mass destruction. And then really new factors, new to mankind, in my view, as we have to consider the risks of existential conflict arising from mankind bumping into the limits of our planet's ability to tolerate us and what that means in states and between states that matter to us. So there's a lot more to European deterrence now than just Russia. And then we need to recognize that for defense and security, the challenge is being posed in new ways. I would argue with many audiences that we have forgotten how to think about war as a feral existential phenomenon, something that never changes over time. But actually, I also think we've forgotten to recognize that the character of conflict changes all the time as a result of the way technology and thinking moves on. So we need to talk about deterrence in the digital age. So how does data and AI and cyber and precision and autonomy and robotics affect the paradigm in the way that we deliver certainly conventional deterrence. And as already been raised today, there have been changes in method. So we're used to talking about deterrence as a nuclear thing, or about conventional military deterrence, and as I've touched on, that has changed. But we also need to recognize how states like Russia have resurrected, I don't think it's new, have resurrected the art of organizing all their levers of power below the military threshold in order to confront and destabilize and if necessary, add an element of destruction. And clearly this touches on things like the manipulation of social media and tinkering in our cyberspace. But crucially, we used to think about deterrence about something between the relationship between armed forces, but much more now the target of this hybrid or gray space or tolerance level of confrontation is civil society, not the military. In fact, the military largely, frankly, irrelevant to it. And two things are going to fall from this. One is, and we touched on in the last session, is so how do you think about arms control in this very much more varied and complex environment? And Greg in particular is going to talk about the INF issue. And then we need to think about resilience. Certainly, if you're British, you haven't worried about resilience since 1990, and we've forgotten that an important part of deterrence, aside from what you can do to somebody else, is your own resilience. You can't threaten to hurt someone if you are essentially a strategic snowflake at home. And we have almost no citizens in the United Kingdom who have any expectation of being required to be resilient. They live their lives in perfect harmony and happiness. And if something goes wrong, then it's the government's job to sort it out. Don't think that's sustainable. So there is lots to think about, and I am going to waste no more of your time, and I'm going to hand the conch to Ambassador Dukari.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction. I'm really deeply honored to be part of this great conference, also part of the new strategy center. From Romania, Bucharest, where I used to be the head of the scientific board during my almost 2 years of think tank work experience until I took over the new job at the European Union Satellite Center. My intention in the 20 minutes that I was given in the beginning of the panel is to try to highlight how new technologies in this age are impacting security, international security, and then also to try to make some points of how we can cope with this and what, for example, NATO could do more in addressing this. Now, it's no secret that new technologies have always been, looked for to gain military advantage, to have military applications. So, from this point of view, there should be nothing significantly new that we have this phenomenon continuing, but there are a couple of significant differences to the way this was developing in the past. And let me highlight some of the key differences. One is the fact that very much in the past, especially the last century, also definitely in the Cold War period, cutting-edge technologies with military applications have been driven by governments. They were generating the necessary breakthroughs, and then while being deployed, a lot of relevant, security elements were thought through. Also, strategic thinking in terms of application came with a package. While we are at the time where the private sector is definitely leading disruptive technological innovation. And frankly, the governments are struggling to keep pace with these developments. And also the fact that they have deep societal impact that can generate the temptation of adversaries to use it. And I don't need to explain to you how, you know, what generates the very confrontational atmosphere in cyberspace, the way the information space is considered also as a battle space nowadays, and how employment more and more of artificial intelligence, analytical tools will change the landscape even more, especially in the era of more connectivity like 5G. I think this needs to be taken into account very seriously, because it's this combination of fast disruptive technological development driven by the private sector with little thought about ingrained security. I mean, we all know how the internet and what purposes it was developed, with no, let's say, structural security elements in it. Can just imagine how it is if we continue in the 5G area with the same approach. You get a lot of readings now of development of AI without all the elements that should include aspects like links to values, norms, and so on and so forth. So this phenomenon of technological development combined with another phenomenon, the nature of confrontation nowadays, which can be characterized, and I think we can say that we are in an age where a number of players, adversaries, are pursuing the strategy of weaponization of everything that is at hand. Every vulnerability that can be harnessed is weaponized. And a time where the confrontation is intense, but definitely driven below the threshold of the armed attack, blurring the difference between civil impact, between war and peace, and frankly, really targeting the societies and the very fabric of democratic, free market oriented systems. If you think at, for example, cyber attacks, the way the manifestation we had in the last 2 years, famous WannaCry, not Petya, indiscriminate effects, large scale, global, one would say that we have a kind of reverse trend from the trend of the previous century, where due to the application of international humanitarian law, due to the concerns of not targeting and not harming innocent civilians, we went, humankind evolved from the carpet bombing to the precision-guided munition approach and the way they were employed. Nowadays, we see the reverse. We do have carpet bombing, yes, not with, weapons, conventional weapons of the past, with cyber weapons, with, information warfare techniques or military psyops techniques that are thrown at innocent and not prepared civilians. So this is extremely important to have in mind, because frankly the whole let's say international system that defines legal norms, defines concepts of stability, has been really built up on this difference between peace and war. I mean, the UN Charter, Article 50, is all about peace, with one exception, right of self-defense, when in the case of armed attack. What is armed attack? Projection of violence in means. Now, what does one do if we have a situation where strategic effects or significantly harmful effects can be projected without, crossing the threshold of armed attack? How can this be addressed? Is there should there be any deterrence forms, principles, and mechanisms be considered that would stop this destabilizing phenomenon and of increased confrontations below the threshold of armed attack? And by the way, what can be done, what can be applied from the experience from arms control? I will not enter too much into the subject because I know it will come after. What can be used from the experience of armed control, for example, when we speak about cyber attacks or AI-enabled information warfare attacks? I don't think we can really classify cyber tools in terms of caliber or megatons like we were able to do with conventional weapons. But on the other hand, we need to find ways to establish some stability, set of principles, norms, and they should be based on the kind of effects that should be, if you want, forbidden or should be avoided. And this would mean an important effort to develop principles, norms, and I would say stability frameworks of responsible behavior. But also some ways to impose costs upon those who are not adhering to these principles and norms and so on and so forth. So what I think is necessary to address in a more practical manner, I think this should be an effort at governments level, but also at the level of intergovernmental institutions like NATO. And by the way, when I'm putting this emphasis on the new technologies, I definitely do not want to discount the importance of, classical, conventional need for deterrence, especially as I'm coming from the eastern frontier of the alliance and the EU. I know that hard power and conventional power matters. So my point is that we need to really balance the focus, the resources to both the, classical conventional planning, but actually avoid what I would call a kind of analog hangover approach, and do a kind of cross-spectrum capability development, military planning, and frankly, deterrence defense approach. So what I think what is key to have in mind for the period to come. Number one, I think there has to be an important investment in keeping up the training, the education of military operators, but at least as much important to have this training and education of political operators, of strategies, of political decision makers, of lawmakers, in what this impact of technologies mean upon societies and on security in particular. I do think there is more need for what I would call a digital literacy at policy level, but I also need that in the, let's say, education of the tech geniuses, those who are driving this beneficial revolution of technology forward, we need to find ways to cross-fertilize their education with that which is related to elements of ethics, morals, legal aspects, strategic aspects. What I call bridging the technology policy gap. We need to invest in this. We also need to adapt strategic thinking to this new technological development. I mean, if you look back to the nuclear era, nuclear technology with military application was a tremendous breakthrough, and it could show it, you know, what it means and how it could project superiority. But this would not have been generating the kind of stability stability based on a high arsenal of nuclear weapons if it weren't for the strategic deterrence theory developed by Hermann Kahn and others. It could have been generating spillovers that would have had dramatic effects. So we need to really understand and transfer the impact of the new technology in a new strategic thinking. This was my second element. My third element is the need to establish a new kind of partnership with industry at government and at the level of the ministry, the military. NATO has a long-standing partnership with industry, but it was mainly focused, for example, on capability development on the, let's say, conventional side, in the long cycles of years, sometimes decades, big platform, ships, airplanes, airframes, and so on. It has to be done really in sync with the warp speed of the digital age. There is an interesting experience, which I'm proud to say I've been part of this development of NATO industry cyber partnership, which was deliberately considered separately from the one of on the procurement side, because it established through different arrangement, MOUs and so on, absolute trust enabled relationship that I would say helps NATO have a functioning and well valuable cyber threat assessment cell. And to be very honest, the most, the fastest and the most accurate technical analysis is received through this partnership. Of course, to get the full picture, it has to be linked also with let's say, Intel analysis and so on and so forth. Number four, resilience. It was mentioned by the moderator. It's absolutely key, and again, I think after 2014, NATO rediscovered Article 3 and also developed a resilience strategy that needs to be constantly updated also to respond to the impact of upcoming technologies. Next, be open to the employment of new technologies. My approach is that you can only fight, for example, AI-enabled cyber attacks or other types of attacks by employing or harnessing the power of these technologies on the side of the defender. And then I would put a question, and I would consider it would be valuable to think what an organization like NATO could do in being able not just to, you know, pursue resilience or be able in engagement in crisis management or the planning for the responses to armed attacks, but what kind of deterrence tools it could develop so that it would deter confrontation below Article 5. And my approach on this, I think it can only be considered as a kind of cross-domain deterrence and in partnership with other players, organizations, maybe like the EU, because I think there should be a set of agreed steps to be taken in terms of imposing costs to attackers that are doing this even below Article 5 in order to stop this, I would say, impunity of attacks below the threshold. And last but not least, extremely important, in order to know when to respond to those who, are trying to abuse what is considered responsible and acceptable behavior in terms of using these technologies, I think governments should invest more, and also international organizations, even like NATO, to support the development of such normative frameworks, so that the actions could be continuously anchored in international law and in what is called the agreed responsible behavior, something that our societies, our democratic societies, would expect from us. You know, coming back to the title of the, there was a conference around the NATO leaders meeting, NATO engages, innovating the alliance. I think it is really indeed a need to innovate the alliance, and this doesn't just mean to employ the newest technologies on the military side, in the military planning and so on, but actually innovating the alliance also institutionally, being more efficient, more responsive in terms of taking action, and actually realizing that we are in a world which is less binary in terms of bipolar world, armed attack or not armed attack. Destabilization can really go very creepy while shaking the foundations of our institutions, of our nations, our democratic societies, and we cannot turn a blind eye against this. So this innovation needs to address this aspect as well. Thank you very much.
Ambassador, thank you so much, and we'll move straight on to Greg.
Thank you to both Lennox World Economics Ideas and the Romania's New Strategy Center, who is our partner in Romania. After spending a decade focusing on how to counter China's anti-access air denial strategy in the Far East, I'm now with the New Generation Warfare Center, where we are focused on helping NATO, EU, and partner nations to defend against states waging new generation warfare. In our view, this type of warfare is a seamless integration of both kinetic and non-kinetic actions, and is implemented across the full spectrum of diplomatic, economic, political, and military security.
For the past 3 years, our primary method of research into these challenges has been to conduct over 20 regionally focused operational strategic simulation activities. So I'm going to make some comments first based on lessons I've learned there. Being the last panel speaker, I've culled a number of things where they've already been hit on today, but I might duplicate a few. And then I'll come back and talk a little bit about nuclear technology and offer some perspectives on the withdrawal from the INF Treaty. So first, I want to talk about NATO, who expanded its borders back in 1990 and not too long after that, without, I don't think, really thinking through what it means to defend it, at least not in the way we're prepared to do so in the Cold War. This defense was, and I think was alluded to earlier today, was well understood and well practiced through the 80s through a series of reforger exercises. Following the Cold War then, it's understandable that there were some who believed we had entered an era of everlasting peace and we did not see Russia as a threat. Now we've determined that Russia is not a friend, has invaded neighboring states, and continues to actively and aggressively attack our liberal democracies. So there's much to do. Good efforts are underway with the enhanced forward presence in the Baltic states and Poland. Then there's a bit of step down, but still good. There's a tailored force presence in the Black Sea region, although additional focus should be placed to the south in Romania and in the Balkans. In addition, we should do more to exploit new opportunities now that it's clear that Sweden and Finland will not be neutral. Certainly, Russia is well aware of this and has greatly enhanced their activities in the Northern Atlantic, which I believe is targeted at reducing U.S. ability to reinforce Europe. Additional efforts to respond to these new generation warfare activities include more U.S. troops in Poland, along with Poland's increase in force structure, the implementation of the package of measures of the Black Sea security, Romania's commitment to the 2%, talked about a little bit earlier, the recent 30-30-30 exercise in Norway, and the upcoming Defender 20 exercise in Central Europe. All these are steps in the right direction and help deterrence. However, in my view, none of these actions alone would be sufficient to stop a determined attack by current Russian forces, such as the recently established First Guards Tank Army. I don't see NATO making the political decisions or NATO forces being able to move to the fight before Russia can achieve key objectives, such as gaining strategic depth around its borders. The result would be the need to move to remove Russian forces occupying NATO territory, something is possible but requires quite a bit of political will and military force. And I kind of say this having, and I'll talk about this whole front, having conducted these simulations on the whole line of this border that we're talking about and seeing how people behave and the complexity of decision-making politically and otherwise. This also leads to the need to enhance military mobility and supporting infrastructure, which has never been more important than today, but so far it's an area of much talk without enough action. This is an area important enough that some even recommend that investments in mobility should be considered as a contribution towards a NATO 2% target. I concur with this idea, but wish to say 2% is a rather crude metric. What is needed is a carefully performed net assessment of what NATO, EU, and partner nations countries truly need in order to ensure deterrence or the ability to prevail if deterrence fails. If so, the Allies must appropriately spend whatever is needed on a carefully balanced package of acquisition, training, and readiness that creates a compelling deterrent and, very important, in a coordinated, fully interoperable way across the alliance. Note that our adversary enjoys the benefits of such fully integrated capability and can see both the challenges for us to achieve this integration across the Allies and either exploiting the opportunity to drive wedges that prevent such integration. Okay, so jumping ahead a little bit because I don't want to repeat things. I believe we need to view what was once flank as now the new front, and it's quite a long one. This is both a blessing and a curse, and factually a 9 times increase in the force-to-space ratio that we faced during the Cold War. In those days, we only had to worry about the inner-German border, and all the Allies knew exactly what they were supposed to do. They practiced it. There are maps and publications you can view today to show who would be fighting and where. While we now have this long common border that in my mind starts up in Svalbard, up in the northern Arctic, all the way down to the eastern Mediterranean and Syria, we do not have equally well-defined plans to protect it. Do we know which ally is going to fight on which part of this long front, like we did in the Cold War? But such a long front does offer some advantages. Russia does possess some potent forces and new advanced capabilities, but they do not have the force structure to defend along the entire border. And this is an advantage that NATO, EU, and partner nations can exploit. In terms of force overall, NATO has numerical superiority if it can get all the reinforcements to the fight and if these forces are ready. Big questions. All allies, NATO, EU, and partner nations along this front need to understand the challenges each other faces, plan together, and be prepared to take action in a timely, coordinated fashion. For example, if Russia appeared to be moving against the Baltic states, that could be the perfect time for a large exercise on the border of Finland, another aviation exercise across the northern part of Norway, Sweden, and Finland, perhaps a large joint training event with Ukraine, a concentration of NATO maritime forces in the Eastern Med or in the Black Sea. As mentioned earlier, the Defender series will help to move forward in this type of training exercise, enhancing deterrence. A maritime example might be, for example, U.S. SSGN submarines visibly surfacing in the North Atlantic and Eastern Med, similar to what occurred in the Far East in 2010. In fact, that sort of message was offered just last month in a CBS News video clip of the USS Florida, an SSGN with over 150 Tomahawk missiles operating on a secret mission in the Eastern Mediterranean. Hybrid warfare activities, cyber, and fake news are being used to exploit the seams in our liberal democracies. We need to recognize that these attacks are just as potentially damaging to freedom as missile or torpedo and respond appropriately. So I'm kind of commenting on your comments, sir, that Russia has integrated all its interagency into one building 2 miles from the Kremlin. What steps has each NATO EU country taken to integrate their interagency or interinstitutional to be prepared to respond to these types of attacks underway? While NATO is a defensive alliance prepared to react to an Article 5 attack, we have reached a point where this standard needs to apply to non-kinetic activity. If it is placing at risk our liberal democracies, we must treat such activities as a form of warfare and respond accordingly. Fundamentally, after years of saying we need to do more with less, we now have to do more with more. There is a great power competition among near peers, and who is the peer and who is the near can be of considerable debate. The potential type of high-end warfare is in addition to the ongoing counterinsurgency challenge that has not gone away. We can't stop those efforts to focus on high-end warfare exclusively. Any idea that there's a peace of dividend, I think, is now long gone. Okay, so moving on to the technology side, I thought I'd touch base on the nuclear threat as it is rarely discussed and then be more specific about the INF Treaty. I see it this way. In the first offset strategy during the Cold War, NATO faced a significant numerical disadvantage against Russian ground divisions, so it came up with the idea of countering it with tactical nuclear weapons. Now, Russia, while having some local advantages in the near, now going to today, is at an overall disadvantage to the total naval force structure, especially as more and more countries such as Poland and Romania take the 2% expenditure target quite seriously. That said, Russia has never stopped its research and development into partial fusion fraction non-strategic nuclear weapons, also known as tactical nuclear weapons. This gives them a relatively low yield and clean weapon with low levels of fallout. While many in the West would say Russia would never use these weapons because the West would respond with an overwhelming force of strategic nuclear weapons, the Russians appear to believe otherwise. They continue to train and practice with their nuclear forces fully integrated with conventional forces. This can be seen by observing activities in their periodic Zapad exercises and a recent large-scale exercise called GROM, designed to test their nuclear triad. But GROM also included the testing of their smaller warhead weapons, specifically the ones that violate the INF Treaty. To my knowledge, the U.S. has not kept pace with research in this type of nuclear weapon that can be employed in a wide range of tactical uses. I believe this absence of attention may have been justified at one point, as viewing Russia as a threat did not generally begin until their invasions into Georgian territory. The U.S. administration that followed this period was committed to what appeared to be an unrealizable concept of global zero. It's a nice fantasy, but this thinking was conducted in parallel with the ongoing technical progress of nuclear weapons development in Russia, willfully denying the reality that some counter to these weapons by the U.S. would be needed. And frankly, I mean, we tried to get this administration get their attention to this problem, and you could not even have the conversation, even in our Department of Defense. Couldn't even have the conversation. This negligence has created a gap. Today, NATO and the U.S. have only the relatively dirty B-61 gravity weapon that must be dropped by tactical aircraft if they can reach the target against modernizing Russian air defense systems such as the S-400 or S-500. I believe the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review of 2008 identifies this gap in capability and takes action to close it with both near and mid-term options, but it's tough to make up for all this lost time, and it won't help anyone in the near term. This topic is probably worthy of its own conference, so I'll stop here and conclude with some thoughts about and ideas about the INF. The Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty, which addresses ground launch missiles with a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers, often called theater range missiles. I think it's important to say the full name, as one abbreviates it as INF. It's easy to forget the word nuclear. In fact, don't we often forget that NATO's first offensive strategy to counter the clear numerical superiority in Warsaw Pact conventional forces during the Cold War years was to deploy tactical nuclear weapons in Europe. The INF treaty came into force in 1987. This was a result of the Soviet Union deploying their theater nuclear missiles, and NATO's response was to field ground-launched and ballistic theater-range nuclear missiles to counter them. The Soviet feared response was that these NATO missiles could easily decapitate their leadership and led to what I believe many would have said a very successful arms control treaty, at least at that time. However, the situation has changed substantially in the last 30 years. Over this time, China, which was never part of the INF treaty, has grown immensely as a military power and now possesses a substantial arsenal of cruise and ballistic missiles that are theater range. Missiles of this range are required for China to reach their goal to dominate both the first and second island chains in the Western Pacific, which is their strategic depth. They will never agree to limit missiles of this type, and it creates a huge asymmetry with U.S. capabilities, which we are now are limited to missiles that can be launched from Navy ships or aircraft. I can assure you that China has already calculated what it takes to exhaust those U.S. missile magazines, and they have far more than that. If the U.S. were to truly counter this situation, or at least become a near peer, it would require substantial development of ground-launched theater-range missiles stationed on limited U.S.-owned territory in the region or that of our Western Pacific allies. At present for the U.S., we possess no theater-range ground-launched missiles. We have ATACMS with a range of 300 kilometers. We have the new precision strike missile, which is in development, and it's not currently designed to exceed the INF treaty range of 500 kilometers. From there exists a huge gap, as the next ground launch missile in the U.S. inventory is the Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missile with a range of 13,000 kilometers, one key leg of our strategic nuclear deterrent, the ground-based part of the triad. Russia is in clear violation of the INF treaty. They have developed, tested, and fielded several hundred ground-launched cruise missiles with a range well above 500 kilometers, and there may be others. Okay, so for those who have allowed themselves to be manipulated by Russian narratives to believe that somehow the U.S. is responsible for escalating an arms race and ground-launched theater-range missiles by dropping out of the INF treaty, may I offer the following analogy. I used to run track, so I'll use that. If China, Russia, and the U.S. were running a 400-meter race around a track, this track representing both the quality and quantity of theater-range ground-launched cruise and ballistic missiles, China has already finished the race and is being handed the gold medal. Russia is on the backstretch with a half a lap to go. The U.S. has not even decided if it's going to run the race. I can't think of a simpler way to kind of describe this situation. This is a great power competition, and the U.S. is losing, but we are certainly not creating an arms race if we get involved in this. But what should be done? Well, the obvious ideal would be to reconstitute the treaty and get China to join it and destroy all ground-based missiles in that range. But how likely is that? Could Russia be deterred from their current path? It is doubtful unless the U.S. and its allies had a countering capability in development and were making plans to deploy them. And that's exactly the situation that led to the INF Treaty back in the 80s. There are three near-term U.S. ground-based missile options that are relatively affordable and could likely be fielded in the next 5 years. As mentioned earlier, the precision strike missile is in development to replace ATACMS, and its design could be changed to increase its range, as its limited range was more driven by treaty and affordability issues than technology limitations. Next, LRASM, although fielded as an air-launched missile, has been tested as a ground-launched and has such a variant could be developed and fielded. Finally, the ship-launched Tomahawk Land Attack Missile, or TLAM, could be easily modified to be deployed in a ground-launched variant. These three options, implemented together, would provide a robust short to mid-range theater missile deterrent to both Europe and the Far East in the relative near term. And probably, if you did all three, it'd probably be $1 billion to do the developments and fielding. Imagine then that these capabilities were then deployed on mobile launchers in, say, Poland and Romania. Would that really result in an arms race? More likely, it would serve as a substantial deterrent for many additional Russian excursions. It would not hold not just their forward-based forces at risk, but also the ability to reach back and hold at risk their strategic air and missile assets. To avoid these deployments, would Russia pull back some of their forward-based offensive capabilities in Kaliningrad, Crimea, and Syria, as mentioned by Minister Chuka earlier today? My net assessment today is that Russia can capture the land they want to establish strategic death well before NATO can get there to prevent it, despite the many deterrence measures that have been implemented to defer them these past few years. A deployment of mobile ground-launched theater-range ballistic and cruise missiles in a few selected states in Eastern Europe would provide an excellent deterrent to such action, and if the deterrent were to fail, this substantial firepower could be employed to both slow the Russian advance and provide the time needed for NATO reinforcements to arrive in the region. And as I said earlier, thinking about military mobility, you know, even working on it, it's going to take a while to fix that problem. Ideally, plans to implement a program of this nature on the part of the U.S. and NATO will bring Russia back to the negotiation table for a continuation of an INF-like agreement in Europe. However, it would be a mistake not to point out that in terms of great power competition with China, the U.S. needs to develop this type of ground-launched theater missile capability to balance capabilities in that region. Perhaps the solution is to develop the capabilities, field as needed in the Far East, and use the existence of these weapons to get Russia to recommit to the INF treaty limitations for Europe, withdraw their missiles, and avoid having the U.S. and allied deployments. So, bottom line, my conclusion is INF is likely dead, but perhaps in killing it and taking actions, we might be able to come back and then get to a treaty state. Anyway, that's my conclusion. I hope I provided some interesting information and look forward to continued debate. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've covered a very broad horizon of factors and questions that affect the business of resetting deterrence in Europe for the current age, and we've gone into some aspects in a little more detail. The floor is now yours. We'd be very happy to join in you in a conversation whichever way you would like. Who would like to start? And I will nominate if I don't get one. Yes.
Hi, so on the question of security, obviously we have all kinds of new technology. I know, Ambassador, you mentioned 5G. But what steps can that new technology sort of take to stop terrorist attacks when terrorists still sort of use rudimentary tactics, like driving a truck down a crowded street?
Stopping terrorism would take, you know, a number of actions. First and foremost, and this is a policy in NATO, is to address the sources of terrorism, or address terrorism at a source, and this way empowering governments, societies, in order to really avoid the development. If you ask me about, potential technological use in the fight against terrorism, there's a lot of possible applications. Terrorism has to do a lot with intelligence, human intelligence, but also monitoring of activity, and from this point of view, having especially the agreed technical surveillance in zones that are of high importance to avoid the effects of terrorist attacks, starting from metro station to railway station and so on, is key. Trying to address let's say this more militarized terrorism with the use of satellite imagery, drone imagery, and so on is another way of doing it, monitoring communications. So, you know, there's a lot that can be done and frankly is done. And there's a lot of artificial intelligence that is employed in this, because with all these new sensors, there's really a wealth of data, oceans of data, which cannot be put to value in the old-fashioned ways, like analysis of human. You need artificial intelligence to flag the kind of anomalies that then need to be presented to the, you know, human analyst and the one that would put the more complex things together. So, yeah, there's a lot that can and is done in employing new technologies to also support the fight against terrorism.
So let me take you on, depending on your viewpoint, a slightly scary or an encouraging path. Inside about 2 years' time, when it is possible to record the DNA of every single person and put it in a database that is exploited by AI, you'll know by correlation the genetic predisposition of everybody in your population, if you choose to do that. Secondly, you can then know how everyone has actually turned out if you can empty the contents of their mobile phone, who they speak to, where they go, what they spend the money on, what their opinions are. Their entire life pattern is in their digital exhaust. Thirdly, given the evolution in facial recognition and other forms of surveillance, such as the Internet of Things unfolds, whether it's your phone, your card, your fridge, you can know pretty much, if you want to, where everybody is all the time. And fourthly, if you can do that kind of thing, then as the autonomy wave of AI kicks in future, you can launch machines, if you want, every machine everywhere all the time, but you could build specific machines to do this, that will in an unrelenting way find the targets which you've pointed them at, whether it's on the grounds of their genetic predisposition, their actual performance, or their location. Now, if you're capable of, as ambassador, of drawing those technologies together, then your counter-terrorist problem might appear different and rather simpler. On the other hand, if you have any faith in the advantages of a certain degree of civil liberty, if a state is allowed to do those things, we may not want to be in that place. But it will technically be possible. Do you want to add?
I was just going to comment that the Chinese society, they're rapidly heading that direction and do exactly what you're talking about. So I think it's your point as you made is that it's going to come back to it.
Okay. We'll use that one.
Hold on, I'm just going to say, is this working?
Does this work? Okay, there we go. I was just going to say, in Chinese society, they're heading in that direction fairly rapidly. So I think it comes down to the technology is going to allow you to do it sooner rather than later. The question is, how much freedom is a society going to allow? And then that has to be compared to what potential damage could a terrorist do. In the coming years, with in a biological sense, a CRISPR-Cas9 system, somebody in the basement creating a plague to wipe out a third of the population, or in this nuclear case I'm talking about, the technology isn't now, it's no longer in secret labs in the United States and Russia. The technology is going after fusion. And that there's direct spill down out of all that commercial work, and billions of dollars are going into it. So again, you're going to offer the potential that individual small groups or even individual people would have access to a nuclear weapon and able to employ it. So I think we're going to have a problem with the society deciding the dilemma between the Chinese system, where you give up all those liberties, but you're pretty assured you can stop that thing from happening, or the size of the impact of someone who can kill a lot of people getting away. And that's kind of the dilemma in my mind.
Okay, thank you very much. Marit.
Thank you very much, Mary Leslie Chatham-Huss. Couple of quick observations and then a question to you, Richard Barons. Just the observation that it seems to me that you are rather overestimating the leap from genetic disposition to actual behavior. And I know of no sort of psychologist who would tell you that in 2 years' time you can immediately map behavior onto genetic disposition in that way that denies free will. But slight observation. To Greg Melcher, I would also just say, I think your model of deterrence, but perhaps I took a very simple interpretation of it, suggests that you see parity as being a necessary part of nuclear deterrence, so that for every one missile of a particular range, you will only deter with another missile of a similar type and range, whereas actually British deterrent policy, for instance, is based on deterring strategically by any means that might be available, which wouldn't necessarily involve a nuclear response of the same caliber or a nuclear response at all to a first nuclear shot. So I would just leave that there. My question to actually all of you, but particularly to our two panelists, is so where do you see the limits of NATO? We ducked the question earlier on that was asked by Christopher Coco, what is NATO for? I would say it's for what it always was for, which is to prevent hostile attack on our peoples, our territories, our institutions, and our democratic freedoms that come from state-controlled attack from outside us. The ways of doing this have become much more complicated, but that fundamental role is the same. It isn't all about Russia, but a lot of the things we've just been talking quite rightly about now, which are real threats to our societies, don't necessarily involve, in my view, a response from NATO. They might involve a response from other bits of our civic society. And I'd like you to ponder where NATO's boundaries lie in this new security threat.
So I'll start, if I may, and I'm actually going to come back to the DNA point. So I'm not arguing that anyone can do this by causation. I don't think that's possible. It's the power of AI looking into a DNA database that determines patterns by correlation, and it says that this DNA string is predisposed this way. And the only other thing you can do is to record how people have actually behaved, and you get a lot of that by knowing them and blah, 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 fine. And it's drawing those two rather clumsy things together that I think becomes quite dangerous. On your question, however, on NATO, I think we are just entering a space where we're beginning to ask ourselves the question: is NATO the right answer for the next period? It's done quite well. Well, it did really well during the Cold War. It's done quite well since the Cold War, but it's not really been asked very difficult questions. And now, when you have ministers in many countries positing publicly that they're not at all sure that they would send their sons and daughters to die for one of the other members of the 29, which they can't even point to them on the map, and when the alliance, as we described earlier, is looking at a number of directions, that maybe this is an alliance that is under such stress it needs to be superseded. And I think possibly the question will be resolved for Europe by perhaps what the US chooses to do if the US has to choose to focus on China, and in order to focus on China properly within the limits of its considerable resources, it has to form some sort of accommodation with Russia in the future. That may not be a bad outcome, but I'm firmly nothing lasts forever. And one of the reasons I think NATO is going to be challenged is really the point you made. It does a very good job, in theory, if it revitalizes itself now anyway, of dealing with conventional, albeit digital age, military problems. And it's never really been designed to either integrate military hard power and soft power, either public sector soft power or private sector soft power. And maybe it shouldn't. Maybe we need something else. It's a really big ask.
Okay. Four quick items in response. I think my point on nuclear technology is that there's a 30-year delta between Russia and the U.S. in the development of the technology of these small weapons, and that's what I'm concerned about. I don't know that you need to deploy weapon per weapon, but if they have a capability and we have none of it, or at least don't have one in development. And the same thing with this idea of theater-level missiles. If we have some developed and we can say, well, we can make a decision, do we really need to deploy them? Maybe that's all you need just to do the development and to get people back to the arms control negotiations.
That would be my vision of going forward. On NATO, I said in my talk about four times, I think, and that's from just looking at this problem from doing simulations all along that long front. I keep saying NATO, EU, and partner nations. So I guess one message is every way I see that you could really defend, it's NATO alone can't do it. You really need a couple of those partner nations, and I'm specifically talking about Finland and Sweden to be on your side to make it work. And I had a fourth one, but... anyway, I don't know what it was.
Did you want to add?
My approach is as unprepared, I would say, NATO still is to address this new environment as unfully prepared. Let me put it this way, because there are a lot of things in which NATO has prepared and also has adapted. And I would agree that it was not designed to address this hard soft power designed to operate deterrence under Article 5. I still think it would be much harder to invent something else and develop it than to adapt the alliance. Now, would it be fast enough? That's the question, how to do it fast enough. NATO has adapted, and there are these days from the Cold War period, it went to the post-Cold War when it engaged in partnerships. As a matter of fact, it had a lot of, dimensions of a that was beyond the defense alliance into a kind of security alliance. It went out of area, was involved in crisis management, for which it was not initially designed for, is still the only place right now where, for example, on cyber threat situational awareness or cyber threat assessment, one can find a quite solid base that is really helpful for any role, for every ally, and probably there are only two or three allies that could have such a situation awareness on their own. So to make a long story short, yes, it is challenging, but I'd rather not think in terms of limits, because I mean, if you ask me, so far I could tell you lots of limits. I would think in terms of pushing the limits, because I don't see what else could be built from scratch. And frankly, one of the way to cover some territory where NATO should not enter and will not enter probably is through these partnerships with EU, with other nations. That's why I'm saying that, for example, having responses to deter attacks below Article 5, I think NATO could rely on instruments that other organizations have. NATO cannot impose economic sanctions. EU can, or others, but it could be part of a mechanism whereby in a certain situation it could apply some level of political, let's say, messaging also with an effect of sanctioning, and it always could showcase the last resort, the possibility to respond with all means available if things get really worse. So it can always be like the last line of defense or strongest element of deterrence if things escalate. So this is how I would see it.
Right. Where next? Yes. Second row there.
Thank you. To us, it's an issue of proportionality. Is it credible that in response to a 0.2 kiloton weapon, the United States should use a 19-kiloton weapon? Is that credible? Would citizens want it? Well, we had briefed the Defense Science Board, and we tried to explain what the Russians are doing with their exercises. And the question that she had was, the chairman was, well, how could the Russians possibly believe they could conduct a limited strike on the United States and we wouldn't respond? On the other hand, we had a workshop where we had, this was during the Obama administration, we had someone from the White House, and we had Air Force officers, three-star general, said, slammed his hand on the table and said, Russians have to understand that we know and believe that we will use, give them a full retaliatory response to any use of nuclear weapons. The guy from the White House said, and that, general, is why if you said that, the President of the United States would throw your ass out of the Oval Office. All right? That's a quote. So the reality is, you know, we can all have our opinions about what we like. Personally, I don't want to see a new 19 kiloton weapon used in response to a 2/10 of a kiloton weapon, which, by the way, we couldn't even tell. With our best analysis, it took us 3 days to assess that a thermobaric use of thermobaric weapons by the Russians in Ukraine was not, in fact, a small mini nuke. It took us 3 days to decide that. So you're coming in and telling the president he should use a weapon when you can't even tell them for sure right now that that's, in fact, what happened. Our point is not that we need to build mini nukes. Our point is we need to talk about these things now. We need to discuss. Maybe there are other appropriate and useful and workable solutions. But to simply ignore the problem scares the hell out of me or my granddaughter and the world that she's going to inherit. We have to think through how the Russians perceive things and come up with answers and not bury our heads in the sand.
Thank you very much. What next?
Thank you. Just a general question for Greg Melcher. You mentioned the nuclear weapons in the context of American global strategy and China. What about Russia and China? The only defense, really, of the Russian Far East is with 30 nuclear weapons rather than conventional forces. There used to be an old joke in the PLA Academy that when we invade Russia, we'll never be able to defeat the Russian army because we'll never be able to find it. I understand 39% of Russian forces, including some of the most modernized, are on the border out in the Far East. But how is that going to change the dependency of Russia on theater nuclear defense in the global context, not just the European?
Well, I think it's a bit like our situation where there's potentially one answer where we could avoid getting that type of weapon in the European theater. But there really is no choice for us facing China because they simply have far more for us to even be in any sort of ballpark. They can keep us out if they want to. So Russia, I think, faces the same situation. Like you said, they have very limited forces on the west side. The quote that I've heard that many times, that's the situation. So I think they would have to then say, well, even if we pulled out of the east side facing Europe, we're going to have to keep them on the west side. But then, what is the status of Russia-China cooperation these days? It looks like they're getting along along better than they did in the past. I've seen Chinese narratives put out that look like they were issued by the Internet Research Agency, so they're doing things for Russia. So who knows? Maybe they'll negotiate something.
So, question, third row.
Thank you. Just wondering, when would a cyber attack be deemed to reach the threshold of Article 5? I know it's something there's been some discussion about, but a few more details would be appreciated by me anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. The way Article 5 was conceived was to avoid any kind of automaticity. for various reasons. And it was supposed to be based on an analysis in a specific security situation and a political decision that would generate this. And it's interesting that the first and only time it was invoked was in a scenario that the founder's father never envisaged. It was after 9/11. There was a discussion in NATO when at the Wales summit there was the decision to link Article 5 with the NATO reason of being with to link cyber defense with the NATO reason of being with collective defense with Article 5. How this would work, and the conclusion was that definitely it would be, you know, based on a political decision in a specific context. Of course, it will be determined by aspects related to what the impact would be. If the impact would be comparable with an impact of conventional weapons that we know, loss of life, significant damage, and so on, it would be in such a context. But frankly, allies even decided that to keep a certain level of flexibility, generality, ambiguity is important, because if there will be very clear threshold defined, then the adversary would always try to just infinitesimal to, you know, act below that threshold. So that's the approach.
Just one comment on that. It has to do with the concept of attribution. The problem, even if there's measurable damage, the problem in most cases is showing attribution. And you can see that in that, you know, our election, the election meddling in 2016, it really has taken almost 3 years for detailed reports to come out that clearly document how this was done. And so by the time you can really prove it, the event could have been 2 or 3 years in the past, if you can prove it at all.
I think a very interesting extension of your question is how in the 21st century we're beginning to understand the evolution of military strategies which are designed to break a peer or near-peer opponent without traditional boots-on-the-ground intervention as the first thing that you do. And a combination of precision conventional missiles, good quality offensive cyber, and good quality social media manipulation is a very effective way of bringing your opponent to heel. Now, set aside the missile aspect, because that's quite unequivocal, I think we ought to be able to think about what happens if some well-constructed offensive cyber attacks have such a significant effect on our daily life that the civil population has noticed and is agitated, but that the physical effects of that attack are then skillfully manipulated through social media so that everybody believes that their lives are about to come to a premature and unpleasant conclusion. And there you'd have to deal with the attribution of both the cyber attack and the social media manipulation. And because people like me can think in those terms, it is possible to do this. And I think conceptually, and Bas made the point about the lag in regulation, I think we're a long way behind. And what we're going to fall back on is the bar of public opinion. And public opinion will tell politicians when they think there's been a breach, and we will be in a new period where confrontation and conflict is not a question of governments pulling public opinion behind them to go to Iraq or whatever. It's about governments responding to an agitated population in a way that may be very difficult to control.
If I may just have a follow-up on the point, the attribution point that was made by Mr. Melcher, you know, do believe we should not underestimate the difficulty of attribution. But let me put it also differently. Let's not overestimate it. And the way I would put it is there's so much that can be done nowadays through technical analysis, through the employment of AI tools, analytical tools, in combination with, let's say, snap fusion with Intel. And why I'm telling this, in most of the cases, the very solid evidence that was developed over, like you said, months and sometimes years was pretty much the same that, for example, NATO's cyber threat assessment had in about 24 to 48 hours. And that was the case also with the WannaCry and so on. So we kind of knew where it comes in a kind of really conflict, warfare situation. We won't wait for 6 months to get to the exact person that we want to indict, like it was in these cases. And that was really well done because it was really good combination between technical analysis and human intel. I think there will be, and there are always false flags, but with the right preparation, with the right employment of tools, we can also offset those ones. And I know there's a important work in this sense. So it can be, it's done faster and more and more accurate.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time, I fear. Happy to continue the discussion at reception later. We can't keep one of the UK's elder statesmen waiting. So thank you for your attention, your participation, and thank you to the panel, and we'll close there. Thank you.